Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 7 of the World Hoppers podcast, a podcast dedicated to helping out new readers navigate Brandon Sanderson's Cosmere, but also provide some discussion for longtime fans who may also want to introduce someone to the series. I am Cheyenne, and I am here with my co-hosts, Alfonsina and Alana.
Hello there, Alfonsina here.
Today we will be discussing The Hero of Ages. We will be avoiding spoilers for the rest of the series, which is essentially at this point Era 2 and Secret History, but we will have spoilers for everything else, including all of Stormlight, so if you're not caught up, go read and then come back. We will be waiting for you.
Yes, always.
Yep.
Something I wanted to mention, I don't know if it's something, if it's nothing, but there's a weird mention of 9 original Allomancers in one of the epigraphs, as the original Mistborns that I assume were given beads of Lyrasium by Ryshek when he ascended. So why are they 9? Why are they original? What is special about them?
They talk about this on the Lord Ruler episode, and I'm not remembering exactly what it was right now. If Ryshek actually changed their DNA, or if he gave them Lyrasium. But I have the feeling it's the former, for some reason.
Oh, he changed the DNA
of
the people, because...
But I'm not sure.
Yeah, but there's an epigraph in which Sestet speaks in the Hero of Ages about the Valance, and Valance has a capital V, because it's the genetical difference that exists between higher class and lower class, which I think is sociologically horrible. It's a terrifying concept. Noble people were literally genetic difference that was a basis for the social classes. And, well, that's just dangerous and not cool. And I'm glad it was over. But it probably has to do with the Valance. I mean, I think they are probably changed after they become Mistborns, because I don't think that Ryshek, when he ascended, would have been able to just say, you're a Mistborn now.
He would have, though. I mean, that is what Lyrasium does. So I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and listen to the Lord Ruler podcast of Shardcast, because they do discuss this. So if you want, go listen to it and tell us.
I mean, I want to know more about this. Especially, I mean, there is these 9 original Allomancers, and there's the first Khandra generation, which are obviously not the same group of people, but one of them are clearly his friends or family or kin, and we know that he had family, as in children. I think that's pretty much canon and confirmed.
Yeah, that's a wob that annoys very many people on the chart.
So, what if the son or daughter of the Lord Ruler is a Khandra?
Because, like, Ryshek changed all the Terrasmane Ferrochemists into the first Khandra generation, except Quan, because Quan refused when they killed Quan.
I thought he turned them all into Mistwraiths.
Yeah, and then he turned them into Khandra.
Well, yeah, the point is, they're the first generation of Khandra, right?
Yeah, he spiked them so that they regain consciousness.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but the ones that he gave, like, Mistborn power, regardless if it was Lyrasium or if he changed their DNA, were, like, the nobles that supported him.
And they were not Terris people.
Mm-hmm. And not his own
they
people.
They were not Terris people, definitely. So, this raises a lot of questions in my head. I have, in my second read through this book, I saw that and I was like, the heck is that? And I can't find anything in my Cosmere knowledge or memory or Coppermine or whatever that can connect with this, so I'm very curious about what the 9 original romances are. And I mean, I don't even know if that will ever be developed in future books. So if we move on to, I don't know, the Lord Ruler, the Khandra blessing, the general Cosmere connections, I don't know.
So we talked about the concept of a sliver on our first spoiler episode, and they call the Lord Ruler many times a sliver of infinity. According to the Coppermine, slivers and splinters and all those things are a very difficult concept to talk about. Like, even Brandon himself, during the interview with him, who's that cosmic character, is like, who have I explicitly said is a sliver? Who is someone who has held a very large portion of a shard and given it up? Or, I mean, there are a whole lot of things involved in the definition of sliver. So I am going to read from the Coppermine here. And it says, a sliver is a human intelligence who has held all or a very large portion of the power of a shard and has since released it. There is a certain threshold of power when one would be considered a sliver of Aedonalsium. Every personnel schedule has a bit of the power of preservation, but they are not technically slivers. Though there is some gray area in what it means to be a sliver, exactly what I said. Individuals who have directly held the power of a shard are usually termed slivers. A human must hold a large portion of a shard, a single beat of the raceme is not enough. And while using the Well of Ascension seems to make one a sliver, touching the Well of Ascension but not holding it and using its power might not. And slivers must have used up the power or released it. And of course, being a sliver changes a person, and there's a residue and all that. The Stormfather has self-identified as a sliver. We don't know if the Stormfather is actually right in this. This is a huge gray area that is super confusing. And they also say Dalinar may potentially be a sliver as he has held the power of honor. However, it is currently unclear. Again, this is a huge gray area. The Stormfather has been wrong before, as evidenced by the whole cohesion tension thing that was very confusing until Rhythm of War. And that's evidenced by a ton of other things the Stormfather has done that aren't actually
bad. I mean, it makes sense because he said that he wasn't as conscious as he is in the current timeline of Rhythm of War as he was when the Almighty was alive. Like, he changed after Tanavas died. He changed, and that's probably what's confusing him, in my opinion.
Yeah, because the Stormfather technically is the cognitive shadow of Tanavas.
I don't know.
We really don't know. Yeah, it is very, very confusing. And he literally says, I am a sliver of the Almighty himself. And it's like, Stormfather, please explain. So this is a very gray area, and like slivers and splinters and all that.
I don't want him to confuse Navani because she is such a technical genius and she needs right information, proper information. And what if she has to correct him? He's gonna be so upset. But yeah,
I really want that to happen though. Like, I need to see Navani correcting the Stormfather.
That would be great because we need some clarity on all of this.
I don't see a way of that happening without Stormfather feeling like it was condescending of her.
True. Yeah, it's all very confusing. So we can't give an exact definition. The best I can do, and what we can do in general, is just what I have just read from the Coppermind. If you want, you can dig into it more, but it is very, very unclear. The point is, the Lord Ruler is a textbook sliver, regardless of the whole confusing thing going on Roshar. The Lord Ruler has held the power of preservation and used it up. And so did Vin, actually, before she ascended in Hero of Ages. She held the power of preservation and gave it up when she released Ruin. So during the time of Hero of Ages and between Well of Ascension of Hero of Ages, Vin was a sliver. So I am curious to see like what changes she experienced, because the Coppermind article and Brandon has said that you do experience like some changes if you are a sliver. So I think that is very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I think that brings us to some just like very like general Cosmere connections.
Yeah, the juicy ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't really had much to say before because you guys are very much the experts here, and I am kind of just, no, that's fine. I'm like just taking this all in and learning. And so I've been really enjoying it, but I do just want to say that I loved the like trial scenes, because that was like some of my favorite parts in Rhythm of War, was following the trial with Adolin. And so like Tensoon's trial was my favorite part in Hero of Ages, just because of like the similarities of like the unjust court system and the like kind of mutiny that almost happens. Because if I remember correctly, they actually like the honor spren decide to ignore the like high judge and that whole thing. So like just seeing that play out in one of his earlier works was really interesting, because you can see where like he's kind of grown as an author following these similar storylines. And so, yeah, I really enjoyed that, and I kind of wish we had seen more of that. I really wanted to see more of the Kandra homeland before they all
Kandra
committed suicide.
Yeah, I genuinely don't know how a lawyer like, for example, Matt, who's comatose on the shard, would stand to read the scenes, because I know he was very frustrated by the Adolin's trial, and he understood that was the whole point of that scene.
You mean a real life lawyer?
Yeah, like Matt is a lawyer, and he has said before that he was very frustrated. No. Matt comatose on. No.
That is the best outcome in the middle of time. Yes.
Matt, who's comatose on the 17th shard and shard cast.
A real life person.
Yeah. And he said that he was very frustrated with the Honor Sprint or Trial of Adolin because it is not a proper trial, which is the whole purpose of that thing, right? And he's a huge Mistborn fan, so I am curious what his opinions of Tintun's trial are.
Yeah, if you're listening to this, please email us or something. Like, we are very curious to hear what you think. Or if you are a lawyer in general and have read this. Because, yeah, this is very much like a farce of a trial. Like, there is no equality. There's no innocent until proven guilty. It's just...
It's just a bit like the one in Avatar, The Last Airbender, that is. I say what happened, and you say what happened, and I determine who was right. But it's like, that's not a fair trial.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, yeah. And the whole thing of, like, where they tried to kill him before he could say anything at the very beginning. From that moment where they're, like, trying to melt him with acid, I'm like, okay, wow, you just 0 to 60 here. He's sitting in pits and next you're pouring acid on him. And, God, yeah. But yeah, this is kind of what makes me excited, because I've already been really excited to see more of the, like, Parshendi. And the singers and listeners and that whole community. And so, like, this has just made me even more excited to see how Brandon writes, like, non-human characters and cultures and civilizations. Because he doesn't try to humanize them as much. Which I think is fascinating and, like, the way to do it. Because, like, we can't expect all, like, other beings to play by the same social, like, cultural rules that we do. So I just thought that was really cool.
Yeah, we're seeing... In the future, we are hopefully soon will be reveal who is the Khandra, the World Hopper Khandra, and I'm so eager know how that character interacts with Roshar. Oh, what are they going to be doing? What are they going to be thinking? I want a point of view chapter. I don't want to just be told the name. But yeah, I definitely agree. He is very good at writing different kinds of characters, like perspectives in life, Odium and Dalinar. I mean, wow. And the shards and the different cultures that you see in all of the Cosmere planets.
For example, you have like Yasna, who is atheist, and Kaladin, who's agnostic, and they still approach religion in a completely different way.
Yeah.
And this is also part of why I am so excited to see Relaynor in the next book and in the back half of Stormlight. Because
I love Relaine so much.
I am very, very excited.
I can't wait to get more of him.
And not only Relaine, but his relationship to Renarin. Because Brandon said we will get more of that next book because he couldn't fit it into Rhythm of War, and I can't wait to see how he handles that.
I love them already, I can't wait to see more.
I mean, the way I feel now about Relaine, it's very similar to the way I felt about Spook, in the sense that he appeared to be like a secondary character, not very important, not very smart, actually. I mean, the reasons why Spook and Relaine do not look so smart are very different. I mean, because Spook...
Relaine was a spy, yeah.
Yeah, Relaine was a spy and he was in a form that was keeping him from thinking straight, and Spook... He was super awkward, he was a teenager, and he was speaking in a way that was different. Yeah, so those are very different reasons to why they are, like, perceived by the other characters are simpler of mind,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, and kind of dismissed.
Yeah, that's the word, not simpler of mind. That probably means something different, but yeah, they were dismissed and not considered very relevant. Even if, I mean, he was a misting. Spook was a misting, and he was...
Yeah.
He was not, a useless misting. He was a teen misting. The way that the Hero of Ages gives Spook a place to develop his character is very reminiscent to me to the way that we are seeing that Relaine will be unfolding himself in the future Stormlight books. Because he's got actually strong opinions and stuff.
Oh, yeah. I think they both work to kind of remind the readers and, like, teach readers that we need to look past, like, our own assumptions about people and, like, how they didn't even ask Relaine if he had a name or anything, if I remember correctly. Like, they just dismissed him entirely. And Spook was just sent off on errands and people didn't make much of an effort, really, to try and talk to him. And both of them ended up being incredibly smart people once they learned to communicate with the people they were living with.
Yeah.
But, like, the burden shouldn't have been on them in the first place to be the ones communicating.
Yeah, and you see that all the time, like, in real life. Like,
That happens.
Immigrants have a hard time, like, for example, getting jobs and all that. Like, even if they have PhDs in whatever field, because they have a harder time communicating.
It's just, it's nice to see, once again, I know we mentioned in our last episode that, like, fiction gives us these places to kind of explore these ideas.
Yeah, I mean, the level of disrespect was reaching Spook being sent to pour the wine for the rest of the crew as if he was a servant. I mean, he was influenced by Breeze, and everyone was aware of that, and they kind of, like, played on, but they weren't sending, I don't know, Ham to pour the wine or something. And with Relaine, I just remember that I finally got the Shen offensive thing in Rhythm of War, because I hadn't catch it. Maybe some English reader probably had, or I don't know, someone who paid more attention, but Kaladin doesn't ask him his name. He just said, you're going to be named Shen, which is kind of similar to Par Shendi. And I only get that when he explains it's as offensive as giving a baby the name human.
Yeah.
So that was so disrespectful, but it was unintentionally horrible and disrespectful of Kaladin, who actually was one of the only characters that was trying to pay attention to the way he felt, the way he thought. So yeah.
So I know you had some more like general Cosmere connections to discuss.
Yes. I mean, something very intriguing or interesting that I found in this Ruin and Preservation pact was the fact that we see in Stormlight how important these pacts are. I mean, the shards are bound by oath. Not only honor. I mean, honor, obviously, that's kind of redundant, but Orium is also bound by some rules. And I don't know if that is a consequence that he agreed with honor to do stuff in a certain way and honor imposed the fact that they had to be ruled by oath, or I don't know if that's a thing that has to do with the nature of the shard, but Ruin and Preservation had a deal and Preservation straight broke it. He said, sure. Yes, we're going to do this, And then he trapped Ruin. I mean, these shards play by the same rules, and they do not play by the same rules at the same times in the Cosmere.
I think that a big part of that is, I mean, Brandon has talked about that in relation to Honor and Odium especially, and how, like, about the pact they made and the Oath pact, which we'll learn more about that in the back half. And also the pact that the shards made, like, what Endowment is mad about, essentially, in her letter to Hoyt in Oathbringer. Like, we agreed not to settle together.
Oh. Right.
Yes.
And everyone is settling together.
Yeah, and so Brandon, let me find it. That's actually a recent... wait a second. Yeah, just keep talking, I'll find it.
Something else that I'm curious about is the way that silver, the metal, is regarded as useless in Skadrel, because it doesn't grant any specific ability, like chemical ability, allomantic ability, and such. We will further discuss this in future episodes, but it has a very special value on Threnody, the planet in which the short, I don't know if the right term is novella or what, but...
I don't know if it's a novella or if it's a short story.
Yeah, that short thing called Shadows for Silence in the Forest of Hell, that's the only canon content we get in Threnody, the planet, that was inhabited by the shard Ambition, which was actually destroyed by Orium. This is information we get from the epigraph of Stormlight. And there, you can't survive in that planet without silver. It is important to that level. You can't survive there. That's something we'll discuss later, but I wanted to remark, now that we're talking about Mistborn and closing up with Skadra for at least Era 1, that silver, it's explicitly regarded as useless. Do you remember any reference to silver in Stormlight? Because I don't, at least.
I don't think there are any in Stormlight, but fun fact, Tin Eyes used to be called Silver Eyes until Brandon realized that pewter wasn't an alloy of silver and he had to change it, and he made it tin, and still sometimes he mistakenly writes Silver Eyes rather than Tin Eyes.
Interesting.
No. Yeah, and I don't know if I heard this in a podcast or if I read it in a web or what, but I know that the metal that has the properties of aluminum was going to be silver, and then he changed it for reasons that I don't know. But yeah, he said it can be the same thing as silver. This metal can be the same thing as silver that I have in Threnody. So he turned it into aluminum, which has the same properties in Skadrial, in Roshar, and apparently anywhere. But yeah, it is different in that sense. And, well, something else I wanted to discuss regarding the shards is that when Bean saw that Elend was dead and she was left without anything else to fight for, and she collided herself, or more like she collided the whole force of preservation, the whole existence of preservation, against Ruin. And that had the consequence of killing both vessels, killing her and killing Ati, and leaving the powers unleashed to be taken by Sayset. So, in regard of what happened to Aona and Sky, which we don't know, we know that they are dead, they were the former vessels of the two shards that
Dominion and Devotion. Not respectively. Yeah. Because, funny, you say Aona and Sky, but you say Dominion and Devotion, and Aona is Devotion and Sky is Dominion. So, I find it strange that you say it different ways.
Well, I do not even recognize the names, so thank you for the clarification.
They aren't in the books until the letters.
This collision between Ruin and Preservation killed the vessels, and we know that Aona and Sky are dead, who are the vessels of, respectively, Devotion and Dominion, shards from Selb, the planet in which Inlantris takes place. So, this is weird, we don't know much about what happened to this shard. We know that it was done by Odium, and that the splinter shards are stuck into the cognitive realm in Selb. But I was wondering, is this thing that we see in Scadrial like an example of the consequence that crashing two shards together has? It's not the same in the sense that the shard got splintered, because, I mean, Ruin and Preservation didn't get splintered, but the vessels were dead, and in Cell, the vessels were dead as well after this collision. So I am left wondering, what is it that Odium did that he didn't die, he was left unarmed, but managed to kill those two vessels and stop them in the cognitive realm? So this is pretty much theory territory. We don't know. So do you guys have any thoughts?
This is a completely uneducated guess, but I was just thinking maybe Odium was able to turn them against each other and they killed each other similar manner, because Odium kind of twists people's emotions and perceptions. So like turning them against each other might work. I don't know. I really do not know much about any of the other shards besides the ones in Stormlight and Mistborn.
No one knows. I mean, this is all theory, and I think that's very plausible, but I mean, we need to discuss a little bit of how are the intents of these shards traducing into the magic systems that they rule. I mean, we know that probably Aona, Devotion, or maybe it is confirmed, but probably Aona with Devotion is responsible for the power that Elantrians have. That's what I think, because I assume that the Elantrian power comes from Devotion. I don't know if Dominion and Devotion mix together in order to give the door, which is this thing that exists in the cognitive realm that kind of fuels the
Elantrians. Yeah, we'll talk about this then, because there is a lot about that.
Right, but I mean, I don't even know. Particularly, I don't know if Dominion is already connected with any magical system that we know of so far.
Dakor. In Elantris. We'll talk about this then, because there is a lot.
Yeah, I promise I'll be more informed by then, but I didn't know that, so...
Those are very old books, mostly.
Yeah, I mean, there's not much information in other books about this, but Ila, I think you have a good point there, because the core and the Elantrian power are kind of opposed to each other, or they have a political struggle at least. So it's a possibility that takes fruit in a fight between the shards from long time ago.
Yeah, because I don't know much about Dekor, I guess, but the terminology with like Dominion and Devotion, you have one kind of almost oppressive thing with Dominion, where it's coming like from the top down, whereas Devotion is usually from like the bottom up. And so I can see how they wouldn't be naturally opposed, or like necessarily opposed, but how that could be twisted to do so. But that's just my theory after reading Elantris like a year and a half ago, so...
That's something that we know. Other thing we know is that there was a collision between Odium, Mercy, and Ambition that left Threnody torn to pieces in the cognitive realm and destroyed the magical system there, or at least made a mess of it. And that's another example of a collision, but we have literally almost no details about what happened there. We only know the parties involved.
Yeah, I know.
But I hope that we will read and find out in the future. And something very interesting, one of the most interesting things that I was wondering, or that at least some of the things that caught my attention the most when I was thinking about topics for this episode. What about the comparison between investiture and anti-investiture, and the way in which ruin and preservation are opposites to each other? I don't think they are investiture and anti-investiture, ruin and preservation, but nonetheless, whenever they were crushed against each other, that had a cataclysmic consequence. So, I mean, I love this investiture and anti-investiture concept that we have been introduced in Stormlight, in Rhythm of War, because it reminds me of the standard model of particles with particles and antiparticles and stuff that we will discuss further in the Squadrial Essay episode. But these are different kind of ways to be opposed. These are different kinds of ways in which things can be opposed to each other. So in that sense, my opinion is that ruin and preservation are complementary opposites, and investiture and anti-investiture is a more primeval kind of things to be opposed.
Yeah. One is more like a conflict, whereas the other one, when put together, they just cease to exist almost.
Yeah, like positive and negative numbers.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Investiture and anti-investiture being plus one and minus one, and ruin and preservation being more like a yin-yang from Asian cultures, analog or metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Thanks to the help of, yes, of a couple of people on the shard, I finally found it.
Nice.
So, this is from the Tel Aviv signing, which was 2 years ago in 2019, before COVID, clearly. And so, Nameless36 asks, all the shards basically agreed not to settle on the same planet. Six of them that we know of immediately basically broke that. So they did not make an oath. There was a suggestion made, and perhaps the people who made the suggestion did not understand that. If you want the shards to do something, you need an actual oath with capital O. And they did not get one. So this is possibly... Yeah. This is possibly the reason the whole ruin preservation thing was possible. Mm-hmm. It was very likely that it wasn't completely binding, which is why preservation was able to just go ahead and create life.
This reminds me of some stories I have from when I was about to finish a book but wasn't done just yet, and I went to people who had already finished the book, and I was like, yeah, so the ending has this and that, so that's very interesting. And they were like, oh, so you have finished? And I didn't answer yes or no. I just kept talking.
My gosh.
And misleading the conversation.
Yeah, Tommy is so bad about this.
I was leading the conversation into another direction so that they would tell me what actually happens at the end, and they were like, you lied to me, you told me that you have finished. No, I never said I was done.
Okay, that is a lie of omission, and you know it.
Yeah, it's like the typical Aes Sedai lie.
Oh my goodness.
So,
that,
yeah.
Well, isn't actually a lie, it's just omitting the truth.
Great, so I know never to trust Alf ever again.
I'm pretty straightforward. I do not lie. I mean, everything I say is the truth.
Actually finished.
I mean, yeah, it could be analog to what I said I apparently do, which is not lie, but not say always the complete truth. But, I mean, don't we all do that all the time? We need filters in our head.
Yes,
we can
but I also don't want to encourage this behavior.
Yes.
So, like, yes, but no.
Whenever I take an oath, I make it for real, so I'm not doing
this. Well,
that
is important, yeah.
But I do think that this is possibly what happened in that situation, that it wasn't an oath with capital O. It wasn't completely binding, and that's why.
Oh, so they were sketchy, these 16 shards. And, well, the final thing that I would like to talk about in this mighty episode, with lots of Cosmere content, has to do with this Themalurgic table that we keep mentioning. We can put the link in the description of our episode, we can encourage you to look at it, but you're going to probably be very puzzled at it, as much as we are, because even Che and I, who have read everything, are like, what is this? What does this mean? It's very, very...
I mean, to the point that there are two whole episodes about the topic on Shardcast. We really don't know.
And it's all speculation. So this table has some information, The particular piece of information that I want to discuss from this table is that apparently destiny with a capital D is a thing that can be stolen with a hemorrhagic spike, that actually might be stolen with a hemorrhagic spike. So Brandon has refused to say anything other than Raffle whenever people ask about this destiny attribute, and of course the same when anyone ask about how can you may or may not stole destiny with the hemorrhagic spike. So we don't know. But what if Sayset destiny was to ascend and become the Hero of Ages? What I mean is that he is a user of Rukimi, that is a metallic art that comes as a consequence of ruin and preservation working together to create the planet, and it seems possible to me that there had to be one person to take both of these shards, that it could have been Sayset destiny, since there were literally prophecies about the Hero of Ages that fitted the events on Divok perfectly. Besides, on top of all that, Sayset was a keeper with the knowledge about every recorded religion through several millennia, which made him able to reform the planet successfully. Unlike Rayshek, who kind of messed everything up and then messed everything up a little bit more while trying to fix the things he did. So, I mean, it's just too perfect that Sayset was able to absorb all the information he had in his copper mind and use it as his consciousness expanded when he ascended to reform the planet to make it healthier for humans. I mean, he made it a nicer place to live in. So, was this his destiny? Is this an example of destiny?
I don't know, he seemed to kind of think it was. Because I remember he was very focused on like whether or not Vin was the Hero of Ages and then he was the Hero of Ages. And so he was focusing on like the pronouns Vin.
Turns out it's gender neutral.
Yeah.
It's intentionally a neutral pronouns.
Yeah. And so I just kind of took that to mean that they were saying that this would happen at some point, but he seemed to think that it meant him specifically. So I'm curious to see what you think about that, Cher.
Yeah, so we don't exactly know where the prophecies came from. Again, one of these things that Brandon refuses to answer. But there is this thing in the Cosmere called Fortune, with capital F. And this is the ability that shards have to see possibilities of the future and, like, connections, right?
Connections.
With capital C. Yes. Notoriously, cultivation and endowment are very good at using this ability. Well, for example, Race was not. I have a feeling Teravangian will be good at it.
Yeah, me too.
Especially because cultivation is kind of teaching him how to be a shard, right?
Yeah. And so that's likely the place where the prophecies came from, right? Preservation or any shard, like, saw those connections way far in the future. Thing is, those are only possibilities of the future. It's not certain. Future sight in the Cosmere is notoriously bad, which is also part of why Renarin is able to interfere with Odium's future sight, like, because it's just notoriously bad. It's the same thing to Mistborn using Atium. Like, if someone knows the other person's future, that will change their actions, which in turn changes the future, and that's why to Mistborn using Atium.
Yeah, it's a spectrum of possibilities, and they are subject to everything, basically.
Yeah, and those prophecies are very old, and they were changed by Ruin, like, the exact verbatim. So I don't know. It's funny, because you look at the Ferrokami chart, and rather than saying destiny for the same, like, general square, right, like the spiritual square, it says fortune, and it here it says may steal destiny, so we have no idea what the distinction between the two of these are. And the famous one that gets brought up in that discussion around destiny is that Kaladin is good with the spear, because he was always good with a spear in the spiritual realm, right? That wob?
Right, that wob is so confusing. I mean, I don't even want to suggest anyone to read it, because, I mean, someone asks a question about destiny and Brandon answers phrasing the information in such a complicated and confusing way.
I do want to add some listener questions quickly. Not all these are Cosmere relevant, all these are just like Hero of Ages are relevant. But so Kiptan from the Legendarium Discord asks, have you ever known someone so mad at the ending that they stopped reading Sanderson? And what do you think that percentage is? I don't know anyone personally. I have heard stories.
Mad at the ending. Wow.
Yeah, because they didn't like that Vin and Ellen died. I have heard stories, and I have heard people who, like, they do continue reading the Cosmere, but they're like, oh, where's Vin? I forget who this is, really, but I have heard stories. And I don't think the percentage is super high, because the ending is very satisfying. And even if Vin and Ellen did die, their character arcs were complete, and they really deserve to rest. They had a very hard couple of years, and they deserve to rest.
I hadn't even considered that some people would be that upset about it, or upset whatsoever. whatsoever. Because I was kind of like, oh, that's sad. I feel bad for them. But, like, that's life. And you could tell going into those fights that they knew that they weren't going to make it out either. And so I don't feel like it was meanly done on Brandon's part or, like, meant to really make us upset.
Yeah, it wasn't the shock value. It was after the character arc had been completed. Mm-hmm. They deserved to rest. And they died. And that's perfectly natural, and that's the way authors should handle character deaths, right? Unless it's something like Alucard's death, where the whole point of it was to cut his character arc off before it had even begun.
I mean, I'm so surprised by this question, by this particular question. First of all, thanks for asking it, Kipton. It's a pleasure and an honor to have you interacting with us. And I mean, I have several friends even here in Argentina where Sanderson books are really expensive, are really hard to find. I have several friends that have read The Cosmere and none of them have been anything but happy with the ending. Every friend I have that has finished the first Era One trilogy is happy with the ending. What I find more often is people who are unable to keep reading it during the political arc on the Well of Ascension. That feels like a slog for many people I have known, and I have to keep pushing them to keep reading, to keep reading, to keep reading, because I knew they want to know how everything ended up being connected with the rest of the Cosmere. But what's common too is that all of these friends that have trouble with the middle part of Era One are people who had read first Stormlight, so maybe they were unimpressed by Era One after reading.
Because it is much earlier in Brandon's career. I mean, it is before he wrote The Wheel of Time.
Yeah, the difference is noticeable. So I think it's a bigger percentage, or at least in my environment of people, of readers, there's a bigger percentage of people that drops the books rather than people not liking the end.
But yeah, thank you for your question. Mm-hmm. It's very nice to get listener questions.
Yeah, I love getting listener questions.
We all appreciate it.
Yeah, so the next one is by Red Murphy 1976. It says, is there enough foreshadowing to know that Sazed, not Vin, is the hero of ages before it is revealed? I don't think I saw it until the end. Now, this is the thing with foreshadowing. Some people are very perceptive, and some people aren't as perceptive. And it also depends on if you listen to the audiobooks or not.
Yes. I mean, if you're a guest from the probably next episode, you will probably be able to find out about this.
Yeah, Cal actually called it before. So, So if you're listening to the audiobook, it's a lot easier to figure out because Michael Kramer does use Sazed's voice for the epigraph. So it's like, oh, okay. But the other thing, Sazed's voice, like a writing voice, like the character
writing
voice,
style,
the audiobook is very distinctive, right? This, with other clues, is what has permitted us to identify him in the letters in Stormlight, for example. And so I do think that the stylistic choice and the way Brandon writes Sazed definitely counts as foreshadowing that Sazed is the hero of ages.
It is possible to get it.
So yeah, I know many people that do.
Yeah.
And that's really the thing with foreshadowing. Some people get it, some people don't. And I do think that, like, the speed you're reading the book at influences a lot, right?
Yes, definitely.
If you are taking time to make predictions, if you're taking time to think about it, yeah, if you're taking notes, for example, it is much likely that you will get it and you will notice these things a lot more. Mm-hmm. While if you're just going through it like very fast and you go through it in just a couple of days, you might just be going through it so fast that you maybe subconsciously notice but don't actually say, oh, my prediction is Sazed it is the hero of ages, not Vin. And so it really depends a lot, like, on the reader. I do think there is enough foreshadowing. Many people have caught it regardless, like, of the audiobooks. And I do
think... I agree
think,
100% with you.
Especially Sazed's voice in the epigraphs and the way the prophecies are and the ways the prophecies have been changed by Ruin, like, is a hint. Just, like, the actual verbatim of the prophecies, like, rather than the changes by Ruin, like, are also hints that it's Sazed, not Vin. So it really depends.
Mm-hmm. Like, I picked up on the writing style, but then, like, the further I got into it, the more I started to, like, question that. So, like, there's a lot of foreshadowing, I think, but there's also a few, like, red herring sort of things going on. So, like, even if you pick up on it at the beginning, like, there are definitely ways that, like, Brandon tries to lead you off the path. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you didn't pick up on it, that's, like, no shame on that. Like, there's so much going on in Brandon's books.
Yeah, I definitely
to, like,
don't
catch everything. Yeah.
I even don't catch some of the very clear references that there are. I mean, for example, the writing style of Seisted in the Oathbringer letters, I think I was only able to catch it because I had just finished Era 1 for the first time when I grabbed Oathbringer, because that's how my timeline of reading went down, because of the publication was just out as I was finishing Era 1. But otherwise, until it is very explicitly mentioned that he holds two power opposed to each other, yeah, I don't think I would have been able to catch it. So, I mean, I actually spoiled myself with the Seisted and Bean being the Hero of Ages, because I had the book in my hand, it was my first time reading the Hero of Ages, and I said, I'm going to open this in a random page near the end, and I'm going to see what happens. And I was kind of doing zapping between pages, and I said, I'm going to read this when Bean died.
What? You give me anxiety. You give me anxiety.
Okay.
That was too much of a spoiler, even for me. I mean, my reaction was to close the book and just dissociate for a minute.
Yeah, it frustrates me to no end that Ronit did the same thing for the Wheel of Time at the end of
my
book nine. And it's like,
Ronit!
No, why did you do that to yourself?
That happens.
I'm losing my mind with you two.
And I'm like, no, don't.
Yeah, I mean,
like, we need to get a spoiler spray bottle for every time that you read a spoiler, just like a cat, where it's like, no, bad spoiler sprint, and just spritz you.
We need to get a Sean Nod sticker for that. I think I have an idea.
Oh, man. I'm scared. This lady
as you should be.
Me.
I love how everyone's terrified of Shay, who is the youngest of all of us.
She has an aura.
She does. So we have one more listener question, I think. Do we want to do that and wrap this up?
Yes.
Yay.
Yeah, because this is going long. This is Drew McCaffrey from the Inking Out Loud podcast, which I have mentioned multiple times on this podcast. Yay. It's probably one of my favorites.
Yeah, we love it.
Yeah,
and the reading order.
Yeah, like he's the one that organized the reading order that we are following.
So I have him to blame for putting Stormlight so far down the list.
Yes.
But it makes sense. How did you feel about the expansion of the world in Hero of Ages? It went from being almost completely centered on Lucidel to major plot lines in two other cities and the passing mention of cultures on the other side of the planet. Did you find that jarring or unsatisfying?
I'd say yes to both, because I'm always trying to figure out, like, what's going on in other places, which is why, like, Wheel of Time bugs me, because I'm like, it can't just be one continent. There's gotta be other continents. Like, whenever you get a fantasy map, and it's just one continent, and I'm like, guys, there's more out there. I know there is. And, like, that's something that bothered me with Roshar. I'm like, where's the other continents and countries? Like, I know there's gotta be more. But, like, Roshar is special. But, like, this one really bugged me, because they give you that top map, and I'm like, that's not enough information. And then they just, like, casually mention that, like, oh yeah, there's people that don't really follow the Lord Ruler down in the Southern Hemisphere, because the Lord Ruler doesn't really check up down there. And I'm like, why don't you all go there? Like, come on, guys! Like, I get that you can't.
Because
just,
people
like,
can't really survive the equator.
Well, then explain that more. Like, I need so much more explanation. And they just, like, keep casually mentioning stuff, and I could not keep the cities straight in my head. That wasn't as much of an issue, because I just focused on, like, what characters were together and not the cities themselves. But I was like, wait, what? And they were talking about, like, oh, this one city is, like, on the opposite side of the dominance from this other one. And I'm like, since when? And so, like, just following their whole journey, Eland would be like, oh yeah, I'm just gonna pop over to, like, Urto and do something there. But then they're like, oh no, we have to go to this other place that's so far away. And I'm like, I don't know where anything is. I can't follow this.
Yeah, I completely understand what you say, Ila. And I mean, in my opinion, coming from Stormlight, because that was my first Sanderson book, Stormlight has this wonderful, huge, continental, planetary map.
We're still missing to know so much. I mean, Eerie, Rira, Shinosar, the middle countries. Yeah.
Having that map, and then having Elantris central role of the map, and very detailed map of the city, but also of the continent, going to Skadriel and finding this very weirdly shaped map.
Yeah.
That has that shape because it is in the north. It's near the pole. I don't know if north. No, it's north. But yeah, it's in the pole. It's in the pole of the planet. So having that map, I didn't figure out it was in the pole. I learned that kind of recently. But I remember thinking, why is this map so horrible? I mean, are they not paying the artist enough? Or does this have a reason? And then it would see.
It does have a reason. Isaac's maps are awesome, and he made that for a reason.
Yeah, I'm sure he did like the best he could there, but it's just a weird map.
Yeah, besides, I would never throw shade at Isaac Stewart because he is like the most wholesome person in the world. He has a soothing voice, and he is very nice and adorable. But I remember I didn't understand anything in that map because my book is a pocket-sized edition, the letters are real tiny, I don't have the best sight in the world, so I didn't get the schedule map, and that was confusing. But I was kind of, to be honest, I didn't pay much attention to that because I was kind of overwhelmed by the events, the ruin being escaping the planet by the end of the saga, so I didn't pay much attention to that and to the fact that they were jumping from one point of the dominance to another. I just thought, as in Isaac Asimov Foundation Saga, in which you have a literally galactic empire, you have a central part with the kind of capital, which is very urbanized and has a lot of movement, a lot of people, it's a central part of the government and of the, I don't know, empire, literally, either in Asimov or in Skedros. So I thought it's only natural that going to the borders you get more diffuse distances, more diffuse cities. So yeah, I accept that as it was. But I was definitely confused by the Skedros map and confused by the fact that the city maps were so detailed in comparison to the kind of continental map you get. So, yeah, and besides, we all know how important are maps to fantasy books. They are like a big thing.
You know, what's super frustrating to me is that in The Black Company, Glenn Cook is notoriously anti-map. They're moving from city to city all the time. The other day I was just like, wait a second. I remember Drew posting a fan-made map the author like signed off on. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna save this because I am very confused about where everything is.
How are you
because
anti-map?
There is no map in the book.
That makes no sense.
Besides, for all our D&D geeks listeners out there, one doesn't realize the importance of having a map until one DMs for the first time. I mean, whenever you're a player, you're like, yeah, there's a map, I'm gonna just quickly look at it, okay, there are places, that's it. And the DM works so hard on that, because without a map, you can't plan a campaign. Even if you're a lax DM that doesn't play much and improvise a lot, you need a map. The map is so important. And after becoming a DM for the first time, which was like when I was just rereading for the first time my Sanderson books, not reading, but rereading for the first time, I was like, yeah, I should have paid much more attention to the maps.
Yeah, and like as an author, like figuring out distances and how the geography should be is, it's really hard, believe me. Which is why I really like that exercise in N.K. Jemisin's masterclass where she is like, okay, start at the planetary level, draw the planet, figure out like general geography from there, like wind currents, water, everything. And then start going down, and that really helped.
I have never thought about that. I mean, if you are writing a story, you have to think about those
it's
stuff.
It's hard.
Yeah, that must
because
be hard.
Because like, that's why I admire Karen, Brandon's continuity editor, so much, because she keeps all that straight on the timeline, including time zones and days and everything. Yes. And I really admire her for doing that, because it is hard.
I've actually tried. I don't know if you can see. This is the map for the continent on the latest. This is the Stone Sky. So the last in the Broken Earth.
Oh, that's Broken Earth.
And the way that N.K. Jemisin uses her locations and the map so well is just amazing, because she's so consistent with like her locations and everything, and like distance really matters. And characters really do spend like this time walking, but not in like the Lord of the Rings way where they're like walking for like 3 months and that's all you get. Like, it's still very interesting. And I say that with all the love of my heart for Lord of the Rings. Because I've been reading this a lot lately, and I was always kind of skim maps. Like, I appreciate them, but I don't use them a ton. And with this one, everything makes sense, and she explains how, like, yeah, there is a continent on the other side of the world, but, like, stuff happened there, so there's not, like, a civilization there. And then there's different reaches of, like, power and stuff, and it's all so well done. So I'm like, can't we get a little more like this from Skadriel? Like, please.
Yeah, I definitely do think that the transition could have been a bit more natural, like more mentions of the rest of the dominances in the first books. I mean, Kelsier isn't even from the central dominance.
Yeah, which I did not know.
Right? I also found out relatively recently, actually looking for fun facts for previous episodes. And I was like, oh wow, I have no idea. And like, for example, Hume and the Kolos lived in the Burnlands, like way back when. And again, things that you don't find out until later. So I do think the transition could have been more natural. I didn't have as much of a problem with like the places and like the maps and all that, so like you do get used to those things.
Yeah, there's so many things in the backstage of writing a book, creating realistic characters, cultures, societies, planets, and yeah, definitely if you don't actively ask about that or think about that, and when you think about this, yeah, I mean, Brandon clearly gets way better at this in future books.
And like,
he still does an awesome job,
yeah,
but he gets better.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Era 2 especially, yeah, the world is reformed and all that, so it's not the same map as the Final Empire.
Life hack when you're a DM, get the world revealed.
Just scrap it.
And fix your mistakes as Sason, not as Rayshak.
But it isn't like only in one location. You travel quite a bit in Era 2. And like even in Roshar. I mean, Roshar is a mega continent, right? It's like the equivalent of Pangaea here. So we can't visit everything. I mean, we're still missing to get to know Eerie and Rira and Babland. I know I said Eerie and Rira. That's a short cast joke. And Shinovar, which we will get to next book, which I am very excited for. Like all those countries like in the middle. Let me see what else there is. I really want to see more of like Yakaved and other like Makabaki kingdoms. Yeah. Like even more of Alethkar, like, because we spent a lot of time in the Shattered Plains.
Yay.
Oh yes.
Yay.
That's probably
the novella.
Farrakh's novella for Horn Eater.
The short novella.
It's not gonna be a novella, it's gonna end up being a novel. But
as usual.
I would not be surprised if it ends up being like a short trilogy. A short
Yeah, and like even if we do have like a lot of things to explore, like on Roshar, have like gone to many places. I mean, we've been at the Shattered Plains, we've been at Durithu, we've been at Thalen City, we went to Yedda in Edgedance, we went to Abia in Dawnshard, we've been to a bit of Emile in Rhythm of War, and we have a tiny bit of Yakaved in Jalan's flashback, so we have a bit of like all those places, but we still do have a lot more to explore, which keeps us interested. So I think it could be like a bit more like that, but again, Brandon has evolved a lot as a writer since then.
Also, I just gotta say, I wonder what the heck the people in the southern part of Skadriel thought was going on when all this is happening. Like, they must have just been like so confused the entire time.
You're having a cup of tea, and no, it's not Trolloc this time. It's the world reshaping itself out of the sun.
Oh my gosh.
And you're now attacked by a Kolos in a multiverse crossover alternative timeline.
Oh my goodness. Well, I think that's all the serious content that we have for anyone.
But those were wonderful questions.
They really were, yeah.
Thanks, Guy. The three of you.
So you can follow us and contact us through all our social media. The links are in the show notes. Join the Discord. The link to that is in our Instagram bio. Or you can also DM us and email us at worldhopperspodcast@gmail.com if you want. Either suggestions for future topics or feedback or anything, really. You can find me on the 17th Shard forums and Discord under the profile Shay and Sedai if you want to contact me through over there. Tell us your feedback, ask us your questions, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Especially questions, we always love listener questions. And if you enjoyed the show, please support us on Ko-fi if you can. The link is also below. And it's on the link tree, like on all our social media. So like we can keep improving. Our first goal is to get some better mics and so we can bring you a better experience. Let us know what you think of the show and what your favorite moments of the Cosmere have been. Tell us your theories about what Brandon has going on in his mind. Lost Metal is coming up next year. And so as we wrap up Mistborn Year 1, it would be appropriate to get some Mistborn theories in for when we start discussing Era 2 sometime. And if you've enjoyed the show, we would love it if you can give us a 5-star review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Rating the show helps listeners find us and build a community around it. Make sure to share the podcast with other Brandon Sanderson fans you know and anyone you want to introduce to the series. We know how hard it can be if you try to explain all this to someone new without overwhelming them. Thanks for listening, and on behalf of all of us, remember, journey before destination.
Bye.
Bye.